Hey, good morning, everyone. We are back and better than ever with my favorite parsha in the entire Torah. I said at the Tillim class, why? It's my bar mitzvah parsha. First and last time I ever leaned Parshas Korach. No kiddush. You can make me a kiddush if you want. But our learning today will be Liuli Nishmas Avigal Malka Bas Moshe, Avigal Rak, who of course many of you know, was a beloved teacher in our community for many years, even long before I came, and a close friend of many people in our community in this room. And I know that it was not an easy journey for her, but she always did it with dignity and with grace. Even when she came here, at times when it wasn't so easy, but she was always committed to coming to BRS as long as she was able to. And I know that many people are grieving, but our community in particular will find a way to memorialize her, to pay tribute to her, and to show appreciation for all of the many years that she spent making the trek from Israel to America to teach Torah in our community, of which we are very appreciative and grateful for. Today, if you turn to page 842, we're going to deal with the very famous story of the hitting of the rock. Now, arguably, there's no story in Tanakh, other than maybe creation, Adam and Chava, that's dwelled upon more by the Rishonim and that is understood less. And as many Meforshim add on reasons for why this all happened, it still leaves you wanting a little bit more and a little bit confused as does the punishment fit the crime? Okay? So let's read a little bit. We'll start at the beginning of chapter 20 with really the precursor to what's about to happen. Vayavo b'nei Yisrael, kol ha'edam midbar sin, b'chodesh harishon, v'yeshev ha'am b'kadesh, v'tamor sham Miriam v'tekaver sham. So Miriam dies. Now why is this going to be important to us, of course? Because Chazal tell us that the reason why we run out of water is specifically because Miriam dies. That the be'er, the well in our sojourn in the desert was as a result of Miriam. Miriam dies. Everything goes downhill from there. Very next pasuk, too. Velohaya mayim laida vayikalu al Moshe ve'al Aaron. So immediately upon Miriam dying, the well dries up. The Jewish people start panicking. They gather against Moshe and Aaron. Vayarev ha'am im Moshe. Vayarev means that there's like a fight. They're fighting with Moshe. Vayomru lemor. Why'd you bring us into the desert just to die? Now, the irony of this is we've seen this rodeo before. We've been down this road before. Okay, this isn't the first time. Basically, since Midbar Loscha, up until now, they've done nothing but complain. What makes this complaint unique? It's the first complaint. Why is it the first complaint?
Because the first time, before they got to bear Miriam, they made the exact same complaint.
Okay, I was thinking differently. What makes this the first complaint? I thought you were going to go in a different direction.
It's legit.
Well, it's legit, right? They are thirsty now. They're nervous now. Okay, but something fundamental happens in between the end of last week's Parsha and the beginning of this week's Parsha. And what is it? About 39 years. Right, last week's Parsha is talking to the generation that had left Mitzrayim. Between the end of last week's Parsha and the beginning of this week's Parsha, that generation dies out. This is the generation that's primed to go into the land of Israel. 39 years, what would you have expected? That the Jewish people would have gotten the message already. God knows what he's doing. He's taking care of us. He's going to lead us into the promised land. And so when the Jewish people panic again at the beginning of this week's Parsha, that's why Moshe and Aaron are like, this isn't going to work. We thought that you had learned the lesson. It clearly, they didn't learn it. So, Vayivo Moshe ve'al Aaron, Pasuk 6, Mibnea, Kahal, Pesach, Moed, Vayiplu Apanehem. They fall on their faces. Vayira Kavod Adonai Alehem, and God appears to them. Falling on their faces can mean a lot of things. What can it mean? It can mean prayer. It could also mean when you just like, I give up, I don't know what to do anymore, right? And you fall on your face. So it could be a little bit of resignation. Okay, now we get to our story. Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk 7. Vayidaber Adonai al Moshe l'mor. So Hashem speaks to Moshe. Kach es hamateh, take the staff, ve'hakel es ha'ida ata ve'aron achicha, gather everyone together, you, Aaron your brother, v'dibartem el ha'sela le'inehem, speak to the rock in front of everyone, v'nasan me'mav, and it will give forth water, v'otzeisa lehem mayim min ha'sela, v'ishkisa es ha'ida v'espiram. And the well will give off water, and everyone will be, I'm sorry, the rock will give off water, and everyone is going to be happy. Vayikach Moshe es hamatel mivnei Adonai kashir tivau. So far, so good. Moshe takes the staff exactly as Hashem had told him to. Vayakilu Moshe ve'aron es hakahal el pnei ha'sela. Again, so far, so good. Gathers everyone together. Vayomer lehem shimu na hamorim hamina sela hazeh notzi lachamayim. Here's where things start. There's a crack in the armor. Because how does Moshe Rabbeinu introduce the conversation with the people? Shimu na hamorim. What does the word morim mean?
No.
Rebels, rebellious, right? Is that a good way to start a conversation? No, that's not a good way to start a conversation. That's a very bad way to start a conversation. Imagine if I introduced my shir today with saying, good morning, all you good-for-nothings. Right? So that's not like a way to endear yourself to the audience. But that's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu does here. Now, when you do that, it sets a tone for the conversation. Okay, the Ramban, very famously, in his Igeret Ramban, says that no matter what you do, you speak peacefully. Speak quietly. Why? Because even if you're not saying something particularly aggressive, but you speak in an aggressive fashion, so it's going to come across in a certain way. Whereas if you speak in a very soft tone, so if the guy wants to get annoyed at you, he's annoyed at you because you're not yelling back at him. So Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking in very aggressive terms right now. And that already shows us exactly where the conversation is going to go. Vayara Moshe es yado, Moshe raises his hand, vayaches atzela, he hits the rock, b'mateo pamayim, with the staff twice, vayetsu mayim rabim, water starts pouring out, vatesht ha'ida uvi'iram, everyone is happy. Until pasuk 12, Vayomer Adonai al Moshe ve'al Aaron, Hashem speaks to Moshe and Aaron. It's unclear Aaron's role here, or it's less clear Aaron's role here. But Yan lo aman tembi lachti sheni le'nei b'nei Israel, because you didn't have emuna in me to sanctify me before the Jewish people. And again, you have to figure out what is the lack of emuna here. How didn't Moshe Rabbeinu sanctify him? Okay, is hitting a rock in producing water any less miraculous than speaking to a rock in producing water? I don't know. If you went outside and did either one of those, I would be pretty impressed, right? So why is hitting the rock any less miraculous than speaking to the rock? We're not so sure. And therefore Hashem says, Lachain, lo saviu es hakal hazeh el haaretz asher nasati lahem. Because of the sin, you're not going to the land of Israel. Hema mei meriva. These are the waters of meriva, of strife, asher avu b'nei Yisrael es Adonai v'yikadesh bam. Okay, what?
It's not strike meribah is
fighting. Shimun ha'morim. It's the end of that bookend of Shimun ha'morim. Okay, so the obvious questions here are, we know, does the punishment fit the crime? Moshe Rabbeinu is told to speak to the rock. He hits the rock. Hashem says, no deal. The Abarbanel very famously says this isn't the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu is not allowed to go into the land of Israel. That really the reason he's not allowed to go into the land of Israel is because of the sin of the Meraglim. But to protect Moshe, Hashem doesn't punish him then. He waits until now to punish him. Why? Because had he punished him at the Meraglim, so then Moshe Rabbeinu would have been clumped together with the whole people. Everyone sinned. Moshe, you also sinned. You don't get to go into the land of Israel. That would have been a little bit of a diminishing of Moshe's kavod. So Hashem protects Moshe there, and he waits for a different time when he can punish Moshe, and he says, now I'm going to clump it all together and tell you you can't really go into the land of Israel. So the Abarbanel says, this sin in and of itself is not so egregious, but it's the culmination of a few sins combined together. That's the Abarbanel. Other commentaries struggle. What makes this sin so bad? In fact, I'll read with you a comment by the Akedas Yitzchak, where he says the following, quotes a Gemara in Kiddushin, where he says, Hare Shulchan, Vare Basar, very sakin lefaneinu. You have the table, you have the meat, you have the knife. Ve'ein lanu pet lechol. But you don't have a mouth to eat. That's what the Gemara in Kedusha says, in a different context. The Akedas Yitzchak takes that analogy and puts it here. In other words, you have all of the pieces of the story, but what are we missing? What are we missing? He says, "Ve'amase asher asa lo ne'elam mineged einenu." We know what Moshe Rabbeinu did. U'micharon af Hashem yisparach aleihem nishdomim livno. We're still not sure why it is that Hashem punishes Moshe Rabbeinu so harshly. So the Torah gives us the details, tells us what Moshe did, it told us Hashem's instructions, it tells us that Hashem gets angry, but there's like a gap in between Psukim 11 and Psukim 12 here that we're not really sure exactly what was Moshe's so egregious of a sin. Rashi very famously tells us that Moshe's sin is that he was told to speak to the rock, and instead he hits the rock. And as a result of that sin, he's not allowed to go into the land of Israel. Let's look at Rashi. Rashi says in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Pa'amayim, right? Moshe Rabbeinu hits it twice. So Rashi's first question is why he hit it twice? What was wrong with the first time? So Rashi says, Lefisha berishona lohotzi elatipin. Don't forget, Moshe was not supposed to hit it. So when he hits it, so only droplets come out. That was Hashem's way of saying, you're not doing the right thing. Lefisha lo tziva makom lakoso. Hashem never told him to hit it. Ella v'divartem el asel. Hashem told him to speak to the rock. Vehema dibru el asela acher v'lahotzi. They spoke to a different rock. That rock did not give forth water. Amru, they said, Shema tzarech lakoso kivar rishona. Maybe we have to hit the rock just like we did much earlier in Sefer Shmos. And again, you can look where Rashi quotes that. But the pasuk over there says, Vihi kisa batsur, that he hits the rock in Sur, Vayatsu mimenu mayim v'shasam, and water came forth, and they drank the water. So Moshe Rabbeinu first speaks to a rock. They got the rock wrong. No water comes out of the rock. Moshe says, maybe we were supposed to hit the rock the same way we did back in Sefer Shmos. And when he does that, he gets punished. Vinizdamelem ososela vihiko. And then that same rock comes back. The rock followed them in the desert. He hits that rock, and that rock gives forth water. Now, if you read that Rashi, does Moshe Rabbeinu's sin appear so egregious? Not really. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu is told to speak to the rock. According to the Rashi, he tries to speak to the rock. He just got the rock wrong. And then he assumed that just as God had told him to hit the rock back in Sefer Shmos, maybe that's what Hashem really had meant here. And so he hits the rock again, and God says, that's really bad. Now, what leads Moshe to that conclusion? Well, there are two things that lead Moshe to that conclusion. Number one is Hashem had already told him to hit the rock back in Sefer Shmos, and that worked. It's not such a crazy assumption to say that Hashem wants me to hit the rock now as well. The second component that I think Rashi is struggling with now is what prop exists in this story that is a sidebar to the story and yet very much is the story itself. Yeah.
Was God looking
for... Hold on. Answer my question. Hold on. And then I'll take your... Yeah. The mata, the staff. Right? The staff is there and yet it's not really there. Because what does Hashem say? Kaches ha-mateh, take the staff, gather the people and speak to the rock. Vayikach Moshe ha-mateh, Moshe takes the staff, gathers everyone, tells everyone they're a bunch of ice varfs, and then vayaches ha-tzel, hits the rock. What conclusion had Moshe made according to Rashi? Well, I tried speaking to the rock, it didn't work. Hashem told me to take this staff. I know this staff because this is the same staff that I had taken many times. This is the staff that I used in Mitzrayim to perform miracles. This is the staff that was used at the... This staff is a miraculous staff. Hashem already told me. So you put like A, B, and C together, it's not such a crazy... It's not such a crazy assumption that Moshe made of, if Hashem wanted me to speak to the rock, then what in the world is this staff doing here? And that's what you kind of have to figure out. What is the role of the staff in this story that Hashem wanted it to be there and yet not to be used? That's kind of, in my mind, the million-dollar question. So the Ran, in his Drashas HaRan, tells us the following. Why is it that the rock that was there previously and here again, last time it was to hit, here it was to speak? So the Ran tells us the following. He says, Ha'inyan kashir kibel tzura achat. Basically, when you do something the first time, gam kitistale katsura hi mina inyanahu, shekibel adavarahu, hatsurahu ashenis, yosir bakalos bima'at pu'ula. Which is a nice way of saying that when I do something once, it's very hard to do. When I do something again, it becomes a lot easier to do. Therefore, says the Ran, he says, I'll give you a mashal. Okay, now I don't endorse this analogy, but you'll understand. We'll temper it down for our politically correct day and age. He says, Hamashal etzli hulatinog. Picture a child. Asher betchila limudo yakeo melamdo b'makel v'ritzua. Again, this is, you have to understand the times. So he says, but let's say you get a child to do something, and you may have to raise your voice. You will use whatever, you employ whatever is appropriate for your day and age and in your environment. V'acharei asher lo made, after the child learns it, im yasiach daito dailo beharos lo haritzua. You don't need to actually, again, I'm not endorsing what he's saying here, you don't need to hit the child the second time. All you need to do is show them the
raise your hand,
and they're listening at that point. Okay? Or in our case, our day and age, there's that look. Right? The look that lets your kids know, I'm not messing around right now. Okay? In our house, the dad has the look, the mom not so much, right? And that's how it goes. There's a look that you give your children. Now the children, when they see the look, they know what that means. Why? Because last time they had the look and they didn't listen, so they got punished, sent to the room, yelled at, whatever the case, lost dessert, whatever the case might be. And they know that that look is like, it's like a Gemara. There's Rashi and Tosos on the Gemara. And the Rashi and Tosos of that look is, you better be listening to me, because if not, it's going to lead to B, C, and D. That's what the Ran says the stick is doing here. The stick is basically telling the rock and the people that if you don't listen to me, what's going to happen? Right? In other words, it's like a Pavlonian dog, he says. And therefore, what he's basically telling Hashem, with the message that Hashem is giving the Jewish people, is just as the rock that doesn't listen and that doesn't speak learned from the stick that the first time it needed to be hit, but the second time all it needed to be done was speak to it, so too you, the Jewish people, you're supposed to have learned from your previous mistakes. In the same way previously you should have learned that whenever you were in a precarious situation, Hashem had helped you, and you shouldn't have panicked and you shouldn't have lost faith, so too here, right? You should be mature at this point. 39 years have passed. We're exactly the same place where we started. So the rock in the stick is kind of a mashal, it's a parable for the Jewish people. The same way the first time the rock needed to be hit, but now it only needs to be spoken to, and it, so to speak, learned the lesson, so to you, the Jewish people, should have simply learned the lesson. You should learn from the past and not make the same mistake over again. And so the staff, according to the Ran, is merely a prop. It's not meant to be used. And so when Moshe then hits the rock, what has he done? He's undercut the entire message that Hashem is trying to teach the Jewish people. That's the Ran in his suggestion. Let me share with you a Maharal. And the Maharal, I think, is beautiful. And I think there are many messages that come out of the Maharal. Let's start with, I'll call it one. Because we're going to go to 1 to 1A. And 1A is really the central idea that I want to share with you. But you can't get to it without 1. And 1's beautiful in of itself, so we'll do 1. Says the Maharal, Ki ha'emuna hu mi sheboteach bo yisparach. Okay, we can all agree, emuna, having faith in Hashem, is important. How do you get, what's the symbol of faith in Hashem, he says? Ein lo bo rak simcha. Someone who has emuna in Hashem has to feel simcha, has to feel happiness. As Rapinkus writes in one of his Svarim, Emuna, faith, or Simcha, happiness, isn't a litmus test. In other words, it's not a prerequisite of Emuna. It's not that I need happiness to have Emuna. Rather, he says, it is a sign of Emuna. If I have Simcha, so that's symbolic, that shows me that I have Emuna on Hashem. Why? Because if I have real Emuna on Hashem, if I really believe that Hashem created the world, that He's involved in the world, that He wants what's best for me, so then I'm able to, as what we call, let go, let God. Right? I'm able to let go and leave it all up to Hashem, and nothing bothers me because I recognize that it's out of my hands, that there's a force in this world, that there's a God, that there's a creator, there's a loving Father who's taking care of me the whole time. So that's what he says. If you have real Emunah in Hashem, says the Maharal, Ein lo bo rak simcha. That person only feels happiness. Sheze inyan Emunah. That is what Emunah means. Shema'amin bo, that you believe in Hashem, ubo teach bo, and you trust in Hashem, v'ima bitachon ha-simcha. And with that trust in Hashem comes that element of joy, comes that element of happiness. Now, that doesn't mean that you're singing and dancing all the time. It's an inner peacefulness. It's a tranquility. It's an awareness that whether I like it or not, I have Emunah in Hashem. And that allows me to let go of the stresses and of the anxiety and feel that connection to Hashem and feel that joy in Hashem. So, Simcha is a siman. It's a test. It's a symbol of my Emunah in Hashem. Picture the following scenario. Guy's walking down the street. You know that he has $1 million in his pocket. If he's walking around like this, do you think that that guy knows that he has $1 million in his pocket? No, right? If a guy's walking down the street and he has $1 million in his pocket, knows that he has $1 million, or nowadays, 10 million, whatever the case might be. So he's like, do, right? He's happy. Doesn't have a care in the world because he's a gazillionaire. If the guy's walking around, on the other hand, and he's depressed and he's slumpy and whatever. So it could very well be he doesn't even realize that he has the check for $1 billion in his pocket. That's exactly what Simcha and Emunah have. Right? If you have that connection with Hashem and you walk around stressed and anxiety, right? So then you don't obviously appreciate what that Emunah means. And again, I'm not saying that we're all at this level. I struggle with this as well. But that's what the Maharal is saying. In its most pristine, ideal form, Emunah and Simcha go hand in hand. Because if you have Emunah, you feel Simcha. If you don't feel Simcha, so that shows that our Emunah is lacking, at least at that moment in time. He says, therefore, Aval im hakas, when a person gets angry or anxious, Ein kan Emunah. That means that there's an absence of Emunah at that moment in time. Because I'm angry about something I can't control, and that means that I don't fully appreciate that Hashem is in control at that moment. Umashe hiku pamayim. So now let's take it back to our story. The Maharal says that there are two things that happen. Number one is Shimuna Hamorim. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to the people and says, you're a bunch of lowly, right? You're a bunch of rebelliousness. You're rebellious people. And then he hits the rock. The Maharal says those are not exclusive. Those aren't two storylines. They're one and the same. When Moshe Rabbeinu gets angry, im hakas, when he gets angry, ein kan emuna. That shows that at that moment in time, he lacked emuna in Hashem. Umashehiku pamayim, and therefore when he hits the rock twice, yoraze al miut hamuna bitachon velachenu kois. That is a symbol of his lack of emuna in that moment in time, and therefore he gets angry. Right, he says, "Ki im emuna nischaresh simcha." If he had emuna at that point in time, he should have felt simcha, not anger, and therefore it means that he didn't have emuna. Okay, so again, they play off of each other, and therefore the Maharal says the following: that was all one, which I just thought was a beautiful idea, something that we should continue to work on. But now he says the following: Avalikar apeirush. What the Maharal thinks is going on for this story is as follows: Ki Hashem yisbarach hayerotze. Sheyiknu Yisrael emuna shlema. What Hashem is doing, the entire journey in the desert, has one goal, which is to extract the Egyptian mindset from us, to develop that sense of faith and trust in Hashem, so that when we go into Israel, we're ready to go. The desert is that bridge. Hashem, in the desert, needs to inculcate emuna into the Jewish people. Didn't work for the first generation, kills them off. This is the second generation. Hashem, Moshe, have one goal, which is to get them ready to go into the land of Israel. V'yiru ki ha-nimtza'im nimshachim acharav yisbarach v'dibaro. In that everyone should be following Hashem. That's the goal here. V'haya hu yisbarach rotze, she'yu kol ha-nimtza'im nimshachim achar dibor Hashem yisbarach, la'sos ritzono me'atzmam. That's the key word here. Hashem wants the Jewish people to follow His word, me'atzmam. What does that word mean? On their own. Lo al yedei hechrachi. Not because they are forced to do it. Uvaze yasu Yisrael gam kin ratzon Hashem yisbarach me'atzmam besimcha. And then, if you train them to do it on their own, and not because they are forced to do it, then they'll do it with joy. Even when they're not being forced to do it. Okay? V'lachach amru sheyidibru el asela. Therefore, Hashem tells Moshe, speak to the rock. Ki kashir yikayim mikoach dibor. Because if I can encourage you, motivate you to do it on your own through my speech, hine ha'asiya hi me ratzon ume simcha. Then when you do it, you're going to do it out of ratzon, out of desire, and out of happiness, and out of joy. And that's emuna, he says. Emuna is not having the Jewish people do it because they were forced to do it, because they were compelled to do it, but doing it because they wanted to do it. V'lafichach im dibur halasela, had Moshe Rabbeinu spoken to the rock, v'ay mekabel dvarav biratzon, and had they done it willfully, without being forced to do it, Hayazek kiddushmo la'asos ritzono be'amuna. That is what Hashem wanted. That was the goal of the desert. The goal of the desert was to get the Jewish people not to do it because they were forced to do it, but because they wanted to do it. That's the evolution Hashem wanted in the desert. Think about how the desert starts off. Har Sinai. What imagery do Chazal give us at Har Sinai? Kafa alayam har kegigis. Hashem places a mountain over their head. He says, do it or die, literally. Do it or die. Sham tekvuraschem. This will be your burial place if you don't listen to my word. We're now at the end of the desert. The Jewish people are about to go into the land of Israel. By now, Hashem says, I'm not always going to be able to hold the mountain over your head. Now I need you to do it on your own. I want you to do it with that joy. I want you to do it because you are intrinsically motivated, not because you are externally motivated. Now, what I find amazing about this interpretation is how psychologically true it is. And just to show you how psychologically true it is, I'll share with you two studies from an amazing book. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's called Drive by Daniel Pink. And Daniel Pink, the whole book is about what motivates us. And what he basically argues is that what motivated us years ago, or what we thought motivated us years ago, no longer motivates us. And we know this to be scientifically true. So let me share with you two studies. First one was done in 1969 by Edward Deci, D-E-C-I. Okay, Carnegie Mellon University, psychology student. Takes two groups of students, and he splits them up, what he calls group A and group B. And he asks them to do a set of basically Rubik's cubes, puzzle cubes. Now, he doesn't treat them the same way, okay? First session, both groups are told to replicate certain configurations. So they're given images, they're given the cubes, they're told to replicate the images that they see. Second session, they're doing the same, only to group A, he tells them that he'll give them $1 for every successful configuration that they replicate. In group number two, he just tells them to go do it. He's not going to pay them. And then in the third session, he tells both groups they're not going to get paid. Right? So one group never gets paid. Group A gets paid for the middle group, but not the third session. And then he is interested to see what finds out. Now, the first session, no one gets paid. So there's no difference between group A and group B. Second session, where group A is getting paid and group B is not getting paid, what happens? First group does better, a lot better, because they're getting paid. They're hungrier. They have incentive, what we call the carrot or the stick, right? They have that incentive. What he finds amazing and what proved his theory was what happens in the third session, which is on the third day. Again, group B has never had any incentive. Group A had incentive, but no longer has that incentive. It's been removed from them. And what he finds is that on day three, group B actually does better, and group A, which on day two had done better, now does significantly worse because they had lost that motivation. That external motivation that was there on day two is no longer there, and they basically say to themselves, well, if I'm not going to get the candy, basically, why bother doing it? So what he postulates is that while external motivations are good in the short term, in the long term, they actually disincentivize us from doing what we should be doing. I'll share with you another study. This was 1978. Guy by the psychologist Mark Lepper and David Green. Very famous study. Researchers are watching children as they engage in free play. Okay? And here's what they do. There are three groups here. One is what they call an expected reward group. Group two is called an unexpected reward group. And three is a no reward group. Now, that is exactly how you assume. The reward group gets a reward for the way they play. They get a little certificate at the end that says, Johnny, you played really well today. The unexpected reward group don't think they're going to get a reward, but at the end, the teachers decide to reward them. And group number three gets nothing. 2 weeks later, this is from Pink, back in the classroom, teachers set out paper and markers during the preschool's free play period while researchers are observing them. Children previously in the unexpected and no reward groups drew just as much with the same excitement as they had before the experiment. Okay? But children in the first group, the ones who'd expected and then received an reward, showed much less interest and spent much less time drawing. Even 2 weeks later, those alluring prizes, so common in classrooms and cubicles, had turned play into work. They no longer had that incentive. They no longer had that external motivation. And so they basically said, why should we do it anymore? We have no excitement. We have no motivation. Whereas the children in the other two groups, who never had the motivation, what were they able to do? What gave them the reason to participate in free play? Internal motivation, intrinsic motivation. They found it. They found the fun in themselves. They didn't need other reasons to find the fun. Now, you and I know this to be true just from parenting, grandparenting, whatever the case might be. It is really easy. I'll tell you, it's really easy to tell a child, do this, I'll give you that. Right? Teachers know that. Do this, you get this reward. It's immediate returns on your investment. The children are immediately going to do what you want. But in the long run, what do you have to get children from? From that external motivation to the sense of internal motivation. And ultimately, you and I both know that if you look at, and this is his whole premise in his book, that if you look at job satisfaction, for example, salary is nice. That gives us external motivation, right? Not many of us would be willing just to do work for free. But ultimately, what drives us isn't that external motivation. There's an internal, intrinsic motivation that you and I find within our jobs that ultimately give us far more satisfaction than the salary. And the proof of this is, and again, this is, I could go on with studies ad nausea, but rich people aren't always happy people. The people who are making millions of dollars on Wall Street aren't always the happiest people, right? It's not, sometimes they are, but it's not always, money's not always bad, but it's not always the litmus test, okay? The people who are really happy find that internal motivation that gets them up in the morning. And that's what happens with a child as they develop in life. They go from the carrot and stick model, if you do this, you get that. If you do this, you don't get that. To ultimately needing to develop and cultivate within themselves a sense of why do I get out of bed in the morning? Why am I doing what I'm doing? How do I find meaning in purpose in what I'm doing. Same thing in shul, by the way, and in religious life. When you're a child, so you daven, because you know if you don't, your parents are going to be disappointed in you, or your teachers are going to be disappointed in you. At some point in life, you realize, wait a second, there aren't really bad repercussions if I don't go to daven. Or I'm on my own, I'm in college, no one's looking over me, so there's no carrot and stick anymore. And that's when you kind of hit this existential crisis of, does this really matter to me? Is this purposeful to me? Why am I doing this? And those are the questions that I think all of us grapple with in work, religiously, right? As we move from that carrot and stick model to a model of, do I have that intrinsic, internal motivation of why I'm doing what I'm doing? That is what the Maharal is teaching us, right? The Maharal, that same transformation that you and I go through in our lives from carrot and stick to from external to internal, is the transformation that Hashem had wanted Bnei Israel to engage in. Bnei Israel at Har Sinai are little Johnny in first grade. Hashem says, do this or this will happen. Take my Torah or the mountain will come down on you, squash, you'll be kaput. So the Jewish people make the right decision, right? You can choose door number one or door number two. Door number one has a ravenous lion behind it. Door number two is candy. Go, make the choice. Free will, right? So we're all going to choose door number two. But by now, Hashem's telling the Jewish people, you're leaving the desert. You're about to go into the land of Israel. Land of Israel where Hashem is going to be much less overt. Because what are they going to have to do in Israel? They're going to have to work. There's no more mun, right? Right now, they're learning in kolel. Everything's handed for them in a silver platter. It's blissful. When they go into Israel, it's going to be much different. Hashem's not going to be as in your face. Overt miracles are going to be suddenly be hidden. They're going to have to work for parnas, right? All of this is going to happen. So Hashem says, now I need you to develop that sense of doing it on your own. That sense of intrinsic, internal motivation. And it's at that point when Moshe Rabbeinu comes and reinforces the carrot and the stick, when he hits the rock, instead of speaking to the rock, all he has done is reinforced into this generation the notion of external motivation. And that's why Hashem gets so upset at this moment in time, according to the Maharal. Because Moshe Rabbeinu has, quote unquote, failed in that moment of leadership, of educating and training that new generation. Yeah. Correct.
Versus somebody who does the carrot and stick. So if Moshe had spoken, he'd be preparing them for the model of leadership in Eretz Yisrael.
Correct, 100%. This is a moment which shows Hashem that Moshe Rabbeinu, so to speak, does not get the Jewish people, or does not get where the Jewish people are and where they need to go. And therefore you have to bring in perhaps a new form of leadership. Okay? The test for all this is, in my mind, the rock itself. Right? Why a rock? Why does Hashem have Moshe hit a rock? He could have had water come out of a tree. He could have had water come out of a chair. Right? Why a rock? So we know that in Torah thought, water represents Torah. Okay? And a rock represents our hearts. Okay? Right? Our heart is oftentimes referred to as an Evan. It's hard as stone. Okay? So what's the message here? Yachol Adam Ligrom Lelibo Lios Kemayan Amisgaber B'Torah Hashem. The whole point is that sometimes you have to break through the hardness of the rock in order to allow the Torah to come out. And therefore, whereas what was hard for the Jewish people at the beginning, the Jewish people back in Sefer Shmos, when Moshe Rabbeinu hits the rock, it's because their hearts were like a rock. They weren't yet ready to receive the Torah. And so sometimes when your heart is as hard as a rock, so you have to hit it, right? You need that external motivation. However, at this point, after the Jewish people's hearts have been open, so you no longer need to take that hard approach to it. Rather, it should be flowing on its own, right? That's the complement to the Maharal. The Maharal says that the intrinsic, internal motivation means that it flows forth from itself and it doesn't need to be hit in order to allow it to come out. Okay? That change, as we've been saying, happens in the desert. And when Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't realize it, I want to share with you a quote from a Sefer, Uvetiv Eyem Osim Torah Mitzvah, Vizeu Dordea Shenachlu Asaretz. This generation was different. They were ready for something different. They were ready for a different form of leadership, for a different form of engagement. And therefore, as you just said, when Moshe Rabbeinu misses that point, when he fails to see the transformation in that educational model, so at that point that Hashem says, you're out. That point Hashem says, you are no longer worthy of taking them into the land of Israel. Let me share with you one final idea. Okay? We've been talking a lot about Moshe's sin. And we've been coming down a little bit hard on Moshe, that he failed to appreciate the evolution of the Jewish people. He failed to appreciate the evolution that Hashem wanted Bnei Yisrael to take. The Sefer Ikarim, Rav Albo, writes that Moshe's sin was something entirely different. And that was false humility, or overabundance of humility. And I'll say why I said it was false humility in itself. Jewish people come to Moshe, and they start complaining again. They said, why'd you bring us into the desert just to die? And what is Moshe Rabbeinu's first reaction? He fell on his face. Vayiplu al panahem. And who has to initiate the change within Moshe and within the Jewish people? Hashem. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Limor. Hashem comes to Moshe and says, Kach es amateh, take the staff. What should Moshe have done? What did Hashem want Moshe to do? So Hashem wants Moshe to act like Nevi'im will act throughout history, which is that the second Bnei Yisrael question their faith in Hashem, Moshe needs to spring into action and to perform an enormous miracle to reaffirm Bnei Yisrael's emunah in Hashem. Think about famous stories in Tanakh. Eliyahu at Har HaKarmel. The Jewish people are really at a crossroads. Baal is enormously popular. So what does Eliyahu HaNavi do? He engages them in a throwdown. Literally, he says, me versus you. My God versus your gods. Let's do a test right now. That was a dramatic display of hit you in the face, God is in charge, stop asking questions. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. Right after the story of Har HaKarmel, Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem Hu Elokim, where do we say those words? Yom Kippur. The conclusion of Ne'ilah is actually modeled after that. That euphoria that we feel on Yom Kippur, where there's just no doubt in your mind that Hashem is in charge and that we are allegiant to Hashem, that's the feeling that Bnei Israel felt at Har HaKarmel. There was no doubt. It was clear as day. Hashem Hu Elokim. Eliyahu did what he needed to do. You have the story of Elisha during the war of Yehoshaphat when the people needed water. Similarly, Nevi'im throughout history made dramatic displays, miraculous displays, in order to reaffirm Emunah and Hashem. Here you have Moshe Rabbeinu. The Jewish people, a new generation, are questioning Hashem. And what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? That he feels unworthy. He falls in front of Hashem and he says, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do with these people. And Hashem gets very angry about that. Because it's not when the Pasuk says, Yan lo ha'eman tem bi, because you did not believe bi in me, it's not just that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't believe in Hashem, but it's that he didn't believe in himself and in the power that Hashem had imbued within him. Right? Yan lo ha'eman tem bi means you did not believe in me being, you didn't believe in the power that I gave you, Moshe Rabbeinu. Because I don't just want followers, I want leaders. How does Moshe Rabbeinu react the first time Hashem comes to him? They're at the Sneh, Hashem says, you're my chosen one, go take the people out of Mitzrayim. What is me? Find someone else, I don't want this job. Okay, that was many years ago. Now Hashem says, Moshe, I would have expected, I hoped, that at this point in time, you would recognize not why me, but yeah, me, not in an arrogant way, but I'm the guy. Hashem has made me the leader. Hashem has entrusted me and empowered me as his shaliach, as his emissary. And therefore, when the Jewish people had come, Moshe Rabbeinu should have reacted a certain way. And when he doesn't, that almost becomes what I'll call a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right? That weakness that Moshe, or that humility that Moshe Rabbeinu displays, is actually what gives, is what makes Hashem realize that Moshe Rabbeinu isn't the guy. It's when Moshe doesn't believe in himself, then Hashem therefore loses faith in Moshe Rabbeinu. I'll share with you a great study, because we're very into studies today, that it's one of my all-time favorites, but that shows exactly, I think, this idea. It took two groups of men, okay? Oh, I have such a good story now, but I can't say it. Because it's about one of my children, and it's a little bit embarrassing to them, so I won't say it. But just know, I have a great story that I'm holding back from you right now. Okay? Anyways, right, so they split the group into two groups. Half the group is given real, good-smelling deodorant, and the other half is given a spray that is fake and has no smell whatsoever. Researchers then give these two groups of men psychological tests, and they are filmed as they are engaging in these psychological tests. Okay? Then they take this film and they show it to young women, and they ask the woman to rate the attractiveness of the males. Okay, so again, two groups of men, some with real deodorant, some with fake deodorant. The men have to do certain tasks. Then they show videos of those tasks to women, and the women have to rate the attractiveness. Lo and behold, what researchers find is that the men who were sprayed with the real deodorant were deemed significantly more attractive than the men who were given the fake deodorant. Now, why would that be the case? Right? The women are watching videos. They can't smell the men. So they have no clue who had the real deodorant or the fake deodorant. What they find, they're being yaser, what they find is that the spray altered the moods of the men who wore it. Right? The woman noticed that those men were more confident and therefore found them more attractive. In other words, it was the good-smelling guy's behavior, not their physical appearance, which made them attractive. Right? So the secret wasn't necessarily that someone else felt that they smelled good, but it was whether or not the man felt that he smelled good. And that's what we call a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right? The fact that they knew a certain thing about themselves meant they acted, they behaved in a certain way, which then fulfilled the prophecy. They've done this study numerous times. Think about in schools. I know we have some teachers here. So if you tell a group of students that they are in, let's say, the remedial class, right? When I grew up, it was horrible. I joke around. I have a few friends in the community now. So when I grew up, we had honors, regulars, and then it was like the dummies. I mean, that's literally what they called it. There was the honors class, the regulars class, and the remedial class. So like right off the bat, you're basically telling a kid you're a nobody, right? But then they also found that with teachers, if they told the teachers which type of class they had, then the students basically lived up to the standard that that teacher felt. So if they told the teacher, you're teaching a genius class, even if the teacher wasn't, the teacher ended up getting much more out of the students because it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The teacher assumed something, and that assumption became the self-fulfilling prophecy. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu and Hashem are engaged in right now. Moshe Rabbeinu basically feels a sense of unworthiness. Yan lo eman tembi, Hashem, I am not worthy of leading the Jewish people. And Hashem comes forward and says, if you don't believe in yourself, how do you expect the people to therefore believe in you and your leadership? And therefore, it's not necessarily a sin that Moshe Rabbeinu has, but it's representing a certain flaw in Moshe Rabbeinu's assumptions of himself, in his ability to lead the Jewish people. And it's then when Hashem says, we need a different form of leadership to lead the Jewish people into their life. Because what Hashem ultimately wants is for Bnei Yisrael to never feel that sense of powerlessness. That assumed powerlessness that Moshe Rabbeinu feels here is exactly what Hashem feels is so dangerous. That's the midah, the characteristic that Hashem wants to extract from the mindset of the Jewish people is that they and their leaders should never feel that sense of powerlessness. Yes? Correct. Right. Right. She's saying by the Meraglim, that was the same idea. And the Meraglim felt that they were unworthy. And that was the root of exactly what, the second they felt unworthy, they acted unworthy, so to speak. They projected. Okay? Exactly. And here's the point. That was 39 years ago. This is a different generation. You have different expectations of this generation. So when the leader of this generation is showcasing that same flaw that existed 39 years ago, that becomes a problem. And that's when Hashem tells Moshe, Yan lo aman tembi, because you don't realize your power, you don't realize your potential, lakti sheni leinei Yisrael, to sanctify me. Right? You, Moshe, you're the leader. You've got to own it. You've got to take that extreme ownership over it and step forward and reaffirm the people's belief in me. And if you can't have that confidence and that belief in yourself, then that becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy. Hashem says, now I need to take you out of the sea. So we saw today, just to review a little bit, is we started with, I'd say, one of the most famous stories in Tanakh, one of the most misunderstood stories in Tanakh, because you have all the pieces of the puzzle. If you remember the Akedas Yitzchak, all the pieces of the puzzle are there, but there's like a huge gap between the crime and the punishment, and we can't really figure it out. There are countless interpretations. We started with Rashi, where Rashi says that it's because Moshe spoke to the rock, didn't hit the rock. We said, but we didn't really understand Rashi. What was so bad about speaking, hitting, not speaking? What was the staff doing there? We showed the beautiful interpretation of the Maharal, where the Maharal said the problem with hitting and not speaking was that it reaffirmed the carrot and stick mentality as opposed to the intrinsic motivation. And that's ultimately what Hashem wanted from the Jewish people, is to get out of the mindset of external motivation, carrot and stick, that mountain hovering over your head is the reason why you engage in your Judaism. And instead, to engage in Judaism because we find the purpose and the meaning and the significance of it. And obviously, inherent in that is homework for each one of us. Right? Are we just doing Judaism because of social expectations, because we have this image of God as this vengeful God, and that if I don't do this, then God will do that? Or do we do it because we have internal motivation, that we believe this lifestyle infuses us with that meaning and purpose, and therefore we want to engage in it? So that was a beautiful idea from the Maharal. And then we saw this beautiful idea of Rav Albo. Rav Albo says that the sin of Moshe was this sense of humility, or lack of awareness of his power and of his potential. And therefore, when Hashem says, Yan lo haman tem bi, he's saying, you didn't believe in me, you didn't believe in the power that I put in you, the power that I gave you, the capacity that I gave every single human being. And once you don't believe in yourself, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You will not be an effective leader for a people that needs a different mindset at this moment in time. As we pointed out, both of these interpretations work because of the gap in between Korach and Chukas. The gap of 39 years, where because it's a new generation, Hashem has different expectations of this generation. And once this generation manifests the same faults and the same problems as the previous generation, Hashem says, I now need to go to Plan B. And Plan B is going to be Moshe Rabbeinu. You're not going to be allowed to go into the land of Israel. Yeshua is going to take over. New people, new leader. Everyone have a wonderful week.